Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The travel facilitated by the Industrial Revolution in 19th century Europe opened vistas for those who could afford the excursions and vistas for the painters who became known as the Impressionists. In this edition of Radio Curious, we discuss the work of the French Impressionists, what they saw, and what they chose to portray. Our guest is Melissa Buron, the curator of Impressionists on the Water. The current exhibit at the Palace of the Legion of Honor Museum in San Francisco, California. Melissa Buron and I visited by phone from her office at the Palace of the Legion of Honor, one of the fine arts museums of San Francisco. We began our conversation on August 5th, 2013, with her description of the exhibit, Impressionists on the Water.
Impressionists on the Water is a really exciting exhibition that I'm delighted to present to our audiences because Impressionism is always such a popular draw for visitors. However, Impressionists on the Water, the exhibition currently at the Legion of Honor Museum, tells a different story about the Impressionist artists. We wanted to pick an exhibition that would appeal to both sailing enthusiasts and art lovers alike because this is the summer of sailing in San Francisco with the America's Cup sailing races out on San Francisco Bay. We knew there would be many thousands of visitors in the city who would find this topic appealing, hopefully find this topic appealing. Since we think we know the Impressionists so well, it was fun to tell this story that I think is less known or not as well understood about the Impressionists. Sailing in the 19th century was a very popular draw for the middle class that had newly available disposable income and leisure time. And also train travel allowed people to travel outside of the city centers to the suburbs to enjoy these places along the Seine River where you could practice sailing and watch regattas. So I think this idea that the Impressionist artists were not only interested in painting modern life, so looking at sailing from that aspect, but also interested in participating in sailing themselves. So in many cases, the artists were not only sailors, but in some cases, boat designers. And I can tell you a little bit more about that.
Well, let me ask you about what does the word Impressionist convey in the art world?
Sure. Well, the term Impressionism, I think it's actually difficult for, or we have to suspend our 21st century perception of that word, because in the 19th century, Impressionism was actually kind of a criticism. So the term arises out of a painting that Monet painted in 1872. It's called Impression Sunrise. It's in the Musée Marmottan in Paris. And it's this beautiful depiction of the sun rising over the water. And the critics really latched onto this word, Impressionism. Now, the kind of art that critics expected to see in the 19th century was not what the Impressionists were painting. So they were expecting to see paintings of grand battles, history paintings, biblical scenes, maybe portraits or perhaps landscapes. And they expected those paintings to look very finished. They expected them to have a very refined patina. They expected them to have a very highly glossed, very highly varnished finish so that you really couldn't even see any of the brush strokes at all, the individual brush strokes. Now, the Impressionists were so interested in painting modern life and painting works with these broad expanses of brush strokes and really making the hand of the artist very visible on the canvas. So Impressionism becomes a kind of derogatory term that critics use to describe these paintings, basically saying they're unfinished, they're done very hastily, they're painted too quickly, they're not done with the kind of attention to finish that we think a serious artist would bring.
Is that true from your perspective, that they're done hastily without the attention?
No, absolutely not. In fact, many Impressionist canvases are very, very seriously studied. They may have painted quickly, but in my opinion, painting quickly doesn't mean that you're not painting with any serious intent. And I think what the Impressionists capture is so evocative of the excitement of modern life. They're painting so quickly because life is changing so quickly as well. Things are evolving. The ability to get on the train and take a trip that may have taken a full day if you only had a horse and carriage, but now you have the train and you can do it in a matter of hours and come back to the city center in the same day. The pace of life is changing, and I think Impressionism really harnesses that energy.
So in a sense, you're saying that this is perhaps an unintended consequence of the Industrial Revolution that was going on parallel to at that time.
One of the most tremendously exciting things about being an art historian is that you really have to be multidisciplinary. So you look at these, in many cases, beautiful works of art, in some cases, challenging works of art, but I think it's so important to understand the context in which they were created. So you could look at a painting, for example, one of the paintings in the exhibition is a painting by an artist named Pizarro, and at first glance, it looks like a very bucolic, pastoral scene. And when you start to look a little bit closer, you see that there are all the different kinds of movement and motion that a contemporary person could have used. So there's a peasant walking, there are people in a horse and carriage, there's a boat out in the middle of the river, there's a factory steam tower in the background, and then there's a train coming through the landscape. So I think that understanding the full picture of what was happening at the time that these paintings were created is a really crucial aspect to their visual analysis.
In talking about movement, the paintings show water as if it's moving.
One of my favorite things to do when I'm looking at a painting by an artist that's considered an impressionist is to isolate certain parts of the canvas. And, for example, if you look at a particular painting by Monet called The Studio Boat, you see that it's a houseboat, or boat that he outfitted as a floating studio, and he would paint sitting directly in this boat on the water with all the water around him. And I imagine that he could have really viscerally sensed the movement of the water. He could hear it. He could smell it. He could really see that movement completely surrounding him. And if you isolate one small part of that canvas, you see that there's a pole that's keeping the boat moored, and so that he's not turning with the tides. But if you look at that pole and watch it come down into the water, you see that Monet takes basically a golden, orangey line of paint, and when it hits the water, it becomes this kind of teal squiggle. Someone told me it reminded them of a piece of curly pasta. And I think it's this ability to translate in paint what our eye essentially takes for granted when you look at water, when you look at the rippling motion on the surface of water, to take that and translate it into paint, I think, is such a tremendously, I would think, challenging thing to do, but the Impressionists make it look very effortless.
So how is that skill developed?
One of the things that makes Impressionist paintings, or the practice of painting as an Impressionist, so different from the precursors to Impressionism, is that the Impressionist artists went directly into nature to paint. This doesn't sound like such a radical or revolutionary thing to us today, perhaps, but at the time, it was just not the way that you painted. An artist would typically go into nature, take their sketchbook and a pencil, some charcoal, make studies of the landscape, and then come back into their studio and paint the finished canvases. Now, the Impressionists reject that idea. There's some pretty important forerunners to that, precursors that help them develop this kind of technique. But what they decide to do is to go directly into nature. And there are a few really important things that allow them to do this. Again, they don't sound so revolutionary to us today, but the invention of the paint tube allowed artists to take paint, pigments, which were very expensive, and if you made them yourself, which was the typical practice, they would be very labor-intensive and very valuable, difficult to produce. So you didn't want to ruin your paints by taking them out into nature and having them dry up in the sun while you're painting. But the paint tube allowed artists to take their paint and work outside. There was also a proliferation of portable easels, so they kind of look like these backpack-type structures. So you could fold up your easel, strap it onto your back, go out into the forest or to the banks of the river, paint all day, and then come back to your studio. But you'd have these finished canvases along with you. So I think that really transformed how an artist relates to the landscape, to the changing colors throughout the day as the sun is either rising or setting. I think that was a really crucial aspect to their practice.
Can we put the Impressionist work into perhaps a chronological perspective by looking at what the main form of artwork in terms of the genre, what was painted prior to the Impressionists?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about what typical training for artists in the 19th century would have consisted of. So if you were an artist in the mid-19th century, and this is going back centuries before the mid-19th century, you would apply to the École des Beaux-Arts, which was the nationally sponsored school for training artists. And if you were accepted to the École, you would study, you'd make many sketches from the works that are in the Louvre Museum in Paris. And eventually, you would submit your work to a forum called the Salon. It was a juried process. So you'd submit your painting to the Salon, or maybe your sculpture, and you would wait to hear back if the Salon had accepted your work. Now, if you were accepted, that was great, because you could exhibit your work in these large halls. Paintings were hung floor to ceiling. And in that instance, you could show your work to a potential patron, possibly have your painting sold, and therefore you could make a living. Now, the Salon jury expected paintings of beautiful women, portraits of dignitaries, history paintings, paintings of battles and biblical scenes. They expected something with a narrative. They wanted a painting with a moral. They wanted it to tell a story. It was supposed to be didactic. It was supposed to educate the public. The Impressionists weren't interested in doing that. They wanted to paint modern life. They wanted to paint cafe scenes. They wanted to paint the regattas that they were seeing out on the riverbanks. They wanted to paint cityscapes. They wanted to paint the life of the world they saw around them. And they were painting these canvases in a very different style than the Salon expected also, because they were painting much more freely and with open brushwork and broad expanses of this very thick paint. So everything that the Salon jury expected to see from a canvas was basically everything the Impressionists didn't want to do. Now, this created some challenges for them, because when they submitted their paintings to the Salon jury, they were most often rejected. Sometimes when they were accepted, their paintings were hung at the very top of the wall, close to the ceiling. They called that getting skied. So your painting was hung sky high. You really couldn't even see it in the mix of other pictures. And in 1863, there were so many paintings rejected from the Salon, they actually held something called the Salon de Refusé, which was the Salon of Refused Paintings, including such masterpieces as Manet's Déjeuner sur l'Herbe, a painting which we now consider one of the most important pictures in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. But it was rejected from the Salon. They said, this isn't good enough. Nobody wants to see it. We won't accept it.
Can you describe that picture for us?
Oh, Manet's Déjeuner sur l'Herbe is a pretty provocative composition. One of the figures, it's a group of people having a picnic on the banks of a river in the forest, and there are two gentlemen sitting with a woman who is completely disrobed, and she is looking out of the canvas, looking at the viewer very frankly, and I think that was unsettling to visitors who saw the picture exhibited at the Salon de Refusé. For one thing, it didn't make any sense that you have all of these gentlemen clothed and one woman who's not wearing any clothes. So what's the story here? What's happening? What's their relationship to each other? And also the fact that she's looking out from the canvas. So she didn't have any shame. She just looked very, very frank. And I think that was unnerving to people.
Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious is Melissa Buron, the curator of the exhibit Impressionists on the Water, revealing 19th century European Impressionist painters. This exhibit is currently available for viewing at the Palace of the Legion of Honor Museum in San Francisco, California. I'm Barry Vogel. Melissa, you've described the people in some of the paintings. How accurate are those impressions?
Well, I think that the Impressionists were first and foremost trying to capture a sense of a slice of time. So with a typical or standard kind of portrait, you might bring your sitter into the studio and have them pose over and over again in the same position for hours. And although the Impressionists did make studies that would take a number of hours, I think the ultimate result that they were trying to achieve was something that felt much more spontaneous. So when we look at a painting, for example, there's a self-portrait of an artist named Gustav Caillebotte in a painting where he shows himself at the helm of his boat, which is called The Roast Beef. And you can tell that it's Gustav Caillebotte, but he's less interested in capturing the specifics of the features on his face and more interested in giving you a sense of the general atmosphere, the light on the water, the movement of the boat.
So the people who are depicted in the Impressionists' work, did they or their contemporaries have an opportunity to see these paintings?
Oh, sure. They might have gone to the artist's studio. They might have gone to one of the Impressionist group shows. Perhaps they purchased the painting themselves, but there were likely a number of opportunities for them to have seen their own image immortalized in paint.
But also the people from the social class that these people represent.
That's an interesting aspect, I think, of the accessibility of art in the 19th century. Even the salons, which I did describe as a kind of exclusive club, the salon exhibitions were open to the public, and there were days when the admission price was less expensive than usual, and thousands of people would come to see these exhibitions. So, in a sense, art was a bit more accessible, I guess, in a way, than we might think based on the exclusivity of the salon and the kinds of paintings that they rejected.
Let's talk about the value of these paintings. They're carefully protected in the museum. The information that I've been able to find on the web indicates that they're from many different sources. Tell us how they get to the museum, the value that's assigned to them, that commands the protection that they deserve in the transfer.
Well, I can't talk about the value, specific value of any particular works, but I can tell you that when you're putting an exhibition together, it's a very exciting process, especially an exhibition like this that has multiple lenders. When you're conceiving of the idea of an exhibition, and I should mention that we had three guest curators for this project. They are Christopher Lloyd, who is the former curator of Queen Elizabeth II's collection, Daniel Charles, who's a Belgian history of marine technology, and Philip Dennis Cate, who's the former director of the Zimmerling Museum at Rutgers University. And they were the ones that brought this idea to the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco, and we worked together to develop the checklist for the exhibition. So you think about it, you come up with a thesis or this nugget that's different than any other exhibition that's ever happened before, and then you say, well, what paintings would I like to have that would demonstrate the ideas that I'm trying to express to the visitors? So you put together your ideal checklist, and I don't know of any curator that's ever had every single painting that they specifically wanted, because you might have an institution that's already promised to lend that painting to another exhibition, or maybe it's not available to travel due to condition issues, or perhaps they say, you know, we just have too many paintings that are out on loan from our museum right now. We can't possibly lend this picture. It's too valuable to our collection. But if that doesn't happen, and they do say, yes, you can have the painting for your exhibition, you start to build the different galleries and the different subject matter that you'll present in each gallery. And hopefully, toward the end of the planning stages, you'll have put together somewhere between, depending on the size of the exhibition, 70 to 100 paintings. And in this exhibition, it's actually very exciting because we have multimedia. So we have the paintings. There are works of art on paper, and there are also some boat models and two full-size boats, which I think will be very interesting for our audiences to see here. You come to the Fine Arts Museums expecting to see fine art, and of course, fine art comes in a lot of different forms. So these boats, which tell a really important part of the narrative of this exhibition, I think are a really exciting and surprising intervention in the galleries.
In the San Francisco area, and I'm sure throughout the world, there are many people who are not likely to go to an exhibit such as the one we're discussing. Do you have ways of drawing a wider audience to this exhibit? Or the this? Do you have ways of drawing a wider audience to this and other exhibits?
I think there's something for everyone in an exhibition. And I think that if you come to the museums and you don't know where to start, you might first go to the information desk and just say, this is my first time at the museum, and I'm not sure if I should go downstairs, to the right, or where would you recommend that I start? We have such an excellent staff that is really prepared on the front lines to help any visitor familiarize themselves with the building, familiarize themselves with the exhibition. There are visitor services folks that are available at the front of the building to help you find your way. We have a number of tours throughout the day that are provided by excellent docents or volunteer docents who train for 2 years before they're allowed to provide tours. And they're just really kind and very knowledgeable people. So that would be, for me, I think a really great way to start trying to understand what's happening in the exhibition. But the beautiful thing about art is that there really is no right answer. So it's kind of like a Rorschach test. I was talking about the Monet's floating studio earlier, and some art historians have said that you can see Monet in this floating studio. And that's what I say, that's like a Rorschach test for people, because you either see it or you don't, but there's really no right answer. We don't have the ability to talk to Monet and say, did you mean to paint yourself in this floating studio? So you can really answer the question yourself. And I think that might be something that would trip someone up before you come to an exhibition and you think, oh, well, I might not get it, or I might not understand it. But there really is no one way to understand it.
How do you draw people who don't go to museums to this exhibit, or people who don't know that there's even an art museum there?
Well, as a curator, I worry about putting the content together in a way that's accessible, engaging, entertaining, stimulating, and hopefully, ultimately, very rewarding as an experience. We have an excellent team in our marketing and PR department that puts together the material that you'll see around the city, banners on streets, the posters on the side of buses, so you might see Impressionists on the water driving down the street as you're going to work. So there are a number of different places in the city where we try and alert people to the fact that this exhibition is happening. And
just quickly, Melissa Baron, where will this exhibit go somewhere else with the unity that it has now?
Yes, the second venue of the exhibition is at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, Massachusetts, and they are a really rich and vibrant sailing community in Salem, so that was a great partner for this project.
And I wanted to ask some questions about you.
Sure.
And one of them is, do you draw yourself?
I don't draw. I have been asked many times if I am an artist in addition to being an art historian. And the art that I practice, or as I consider it, I think that the writing that I do about art and the tours that I give and the stories that I share with people, that's my version of the art that I produce.
As is radio for me.
Yes, exactly.
Let me ask a little bit more about you, and particularly, can you tell us of a eureka or an aha moment that you remember and which has changed your life?
Yes, absolutely. I came to the Legion of Honor Museum in the summer of 2006, and it was the summer before I went to London to do my master's degree, to study for my master's. And I came to the museum. I was just overwhelmed with the beauty of the setting, the elegance of the building. I saw a particular painting that really stood out to me, and I remember taking a picture with it. It was a painting by a Victorian artist, and I really love Victorian art. I had planned to study it in London, and I was just so surprised and excited to see it in San Francisco. So I go off to London, and I had planned to write about several different topics for my dissertation, and by the time I got to starting the research and doing the writing, nothing really felt right. I tried one topic, and then I said, no, this isn't it. Then I tried another topic, and I said, no, this isn't it either. And I just had to start from scratch, go back to the drawing board. And I thought to myself, what about that beautiful painting that I saw in San Francisco? I don't know anything about that artist. It's an artist named John Rodham Spencer Stanhope. And I thought, well, maybe I should look into it. I wonder if there's a book about him, and what can I find about him? As it turned out, there's no monograph yet published on him, and I thought, okay, this is really a gold mine for any art historian to find a subject that really hasn't been given much research before. And I wrote a dissertation that was really personally meaningful for me. I looked back on that moment of coming to the museums in the summer before I went to London and being so moved by this painting, and that's stuck with me all through those many months of doing research, and I think ultimately led to the position that I have at the museums today.
And can you tell us what you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Being a curator is a tremendous honor. The Latin root of the word curator is curare, which means to care for. And that's what we do as curators. We don't own these paintings. We don't own the stories. We don't own the legacy of these artists, but we get to care for them and shepherd them and take care of these collections in a way that hopefully will live on beyond us. So I hope that I can continue to share these wonderful stories with the public and hopefully do that for many years.
And finally, Melissa Baran, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
One of my favorite novels is by the English writer A.S. Byatt, and it's a novel called Possession. She won the Booker Prize for this novel, and it was a mystery, historical love story, but it tells the ways that you can be changed by trying to follow your bliss, so to speak. It can be very enlightening.
Melissa Baran, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
My pleasure. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. And Impressionists on the Water will be open through October 13th at the Legion of Honor. So please do come and see this show.
Melissa Baran is the curator of the exhibit of European Impressionist artists entitled Impressionists on the Water, currently on exhibit at the Palace of the Legion of Honor Museum, one of the fine arts museums of San Francisco, California. The book Melissa Baran recommends is Possession by A.S. Byatt, B-Y-A-T-T. This program was recorded on August 5th, 2013. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.